I'm Brian McCreath from WCRB with Thomas Wilkins, the youth and family concerts conductor of the Boston Symphony. And I believe this is your subscription debut concert. Am I right, Mr. Wilkins?
That's what they tell me, so I guess it is.
Fair enough. Well, it's a fascinating program. I'm so glad you're doing it. And some music that this orchestra has never played in some cases, maybe all cases, I don't know. But let's talk a little bit about the different pieces on the program. And the Hail Stork piece, the overture, is something that I understand that you have conducted pretty much everything that Hail Stork has written for orchestra. Tell me what it is about his music that is distinctive and what draws you to it.
Interestingly, I've conducted just about everything except that piece. So I was new to that. I mean, I knew of the piece, and it just never appeared on my radar to program. It's funny because when I'm conducting his music, I feel like I know exactly where I am. I know his language. I know what it is that he's trying to say. I know what his gestures mean, and therefore how they should be articulated. And part of it is because I've known him for so long, and that's part of the equation. But really what I love about this music is that it's always well-crafted. There's never anything clumsy about it, unless it's clumsy on purpose. So it's always a joy. I always have to pay attention though, which is kind of bugs me, but that's my problem, not his.
Well, it's a rip-roaring overture. I've just had such a good time listening to it. All kinds of things going on with it, all kinds of energy. So I'm really glad you brought it to the orchestra. The concerto for saxophones by Roberto Sierra and James Carter playing it, this is one of those pieces where it seems like the line is completely blurred between what is James Carter and what is Roberto Sierra. How did you get to know this piece and how did you get to know James Carter?
When I was the resident conductor of the Detroit Symphony, the DSO made a decision that they had to figure out how to be Detroit's orchestra. And James Carter is a Detroit figure, and jazz is a Detroit voice. The idea came to commission a piece for James Carter, and Roberto Sierra was the guy that they decided to use at the time. But you're exactly right. I didn't conduct the premiere. Namie Yarvey, but I'm sitting in the audience, and I'm realizing how visceral the response is from the audience. I mean, it was like they were in a jazz club, and they applauded after the second movement ballad. They hooted and hollered and from time to time and yelped, and I realized that this was a piece that the audience could get in their blood very quickly, I started booking the piece, and I did it first in Omaha, where I am still music director. But we've done it in a various number of places now over the last few years, and now it's almost like the Hail Stork. We know each other's language and movement. We can communicate on stage without words, which is pretty cool. But it does blur the line because this is the brilliance of the piece. Sometimes it sounds like he's improvising, but he's actually reading. And other times, it sounds like he's reading, but he's actually improvising. Because the orchestra goes along in its place, he just has to know where the orchestra is so that he comes out of it. Because when he comes out of his improvisation, the orchestra is in a very specific place. And he has to now get back to his written part in that same specific place. So it's tricky for him, but he does it seamlessly.
But as you describe it, I wonder how different this piece comes across, or really how different the orchestra is with this piece, depending on where you're going with it. It must change a lot more than other pieces from place to place.
Yeah, it's. I said to him the last time that we did it, we were in New Orleans, and I said, you know what? It sounds as if both of you, the orchestra and the soloist, is trying to convince each other that their sound world is the world in which you belong. And so this piece starts off within 4 seconds. It's a classical piece of music. But then a tenor sax comes in, and you think, well, that doesn't sound right. You know, and it's not the tenor sax from Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances. This is a different tenor sax sound, right? And so you think, well, wait a minute. He's playing written music, but it clearly sounds like it's a jazz lick, right? Lick, not gesture, a lick. And so all of a sudden, the orchestra starts, there's buy-in from the orchestra, all right? And so then you get to the end of that movement, and all right, so it's a jazz piece. And this beautiful melody starts the second movement that you think, oh, this is just a slow movement of a regular concerto. But then this soprano sax comes in, you know? And all of a sudden, and interestingly, the soprano sax enters playing the music that has already been played. But within 10 seconds, he's improvising. And you think, okay, I guess this is a jazz ballad. Well, all of a sudden, the orchestra buys into the jazz ballad, but then pulls away from that and plays quote-unquote classical music again. When the orchestra gets its turn to speak, it's playing what sounds like any slow movement from any concerto. And we think, all right, there we are. We're back in the classical world. Even James is back in the classical world. And then this scherzo happens, and it's clearly a classical scherzo. Even he's playing on tenor saxophone. It sounds like he's playing classical music. And then at the end of the scherzo, he plays a cadenza. But then he breaks into this 12-bar blues lick at the end of this cadenza, and it's almost like, okay, everybody in the room said, okay, the heck with it. We're just going to play jazz. And that's what they play for the whole rest of the concerto. I mean, it's like, where am I, for crying out loud? But it's a lot of fun.
It is, and a lot of credit to Sierra for the orchestration, yeah. Especially in that slow movement. The way the soprano sax interleaves with the instruments of the orchestra, right. That Sierra has orchestrated is just brilliant orchestration. Yeah. Tell me about how you came to Florence Price's Third Symphony and how your choices evolved or in how to perform that as what you're calling symphonic reflections for this program.
Well, full disclosure, part of it was I wanted Florence Price's music on the program, but I only had an X number of minutes to work with. And so I thought, okay, where's the compromise? And so the compromise was, or let's just create a fast, slow, fast sort of scenario so that we can have a sense that we're almost getting a complete piece and be able to do it and still have, because I really wanted the Ellington on the program. And what it does is it creates a balance on both halves. There's kind of a symmetry because there's this clearly classical composer who intimates jazz in Adolphus Hailstork, those twisted bends in the clarinet and then the trumpet, muted trumpet. And then there's an all-out, sure enough, quote-unquote jazz piece concerto. And then the second half is sort of a mirror of that. This is clearly a classical piece of music of Florence Price, but she writes in her own quote-unquote Negro language, which is her intent with this piece. And so there's music that sounds like period music. You know, there's dance music. There's an African dance, the Juba movement. And then, of course, Duke Ellington. So I wanted that symmetry, and I like that symmetry. And Florence is just now being rediscovered for some reason. I have done this music. Well, that's not true. I've done that some of her music earlier in my career and never got back to it. So I'm as guilty as everybody else, quite frankly. So now that there's a resurgence of her and a noticing of her orchestras all across America. I mean, I'm doing a piano concerto 3 times next season, you know, in 3 different places. there is this rediscovery, and the beauty of it is that no one's questioning what she writes. They're validating what she writes. And for a woman growing up pre-Jim Crow South, to be able to pull off what she pulled off, and also to be able to coin an expression from a writer I've read, to let beauty have the last word in her life, when everything around her, including her own personal life, is not necessarily the smoothest, she still chooses to write music that gives us hope and promise.
So let's pick up on that, though, a little bit, because you're right. There are so many people now who are noticing Florence Price. There was a discovery of a whole bunch of her music that people didn't know about before. And as you've gotten deeper and deeper into it and taken on these projects that are bringing her music into more of the public eye, is there any way you can characterize what is it that we're going to hear when we hear more Florence Price? It sort of feels inevitable that we're going to hear more. And what's that voice going to add to what orchestral music is right now?
I have used the expression that Florence Price is comfortable in her own skin. And in fact, I've used that expression about me, quite frankly, because you have to get to a stage in your life where you're not trying to impress anyone. You're not trying to pad your resume. And you're just saying, you know what, I'm just going to show you who I am, and you'll have to take it or leave it. But it's going to be an honest portrayal of who I am, not something that I'm trying to drum up so you'll feel a certain way about my ability or a certain way about my background or a certain way about my training or even a certain way about my aesthetic. I'm just going to be me. And I think there are people like her and William Grant Still and W.C. Handy who they just wrote from their experience. A friend of mine who's in Hollywood talked about how the reason that old comedies were so fresh and real is that they were written by people who actually played stickball in the street, as opposed to stuff nowadays, which is written by people who read about people who played stickball in the street. So there's a detachment from real life, in a sense, and this is not the case with Florence Price. And I think that's it in a nutshell. I said to the orchestra, both here and a few weeks ago when I did it in L.A., I said, I get to this music now at this age in my life where I'm over 60, just barely, and there's a certain maturity that has come to me as a human being and as a man that I had to now bring to this music because I wanted this music to be something else. I wanted it to be, I said this to the orchestra earlier this week, I wanted it to be American music like Samuel Barber wrote American music, which is basically European music, right? And these composers were saying, but that's not who we are. And I had to get to a place in my life where I thought, well, that's right. So this needs to be taken seriously. And I think I thought back, and I often think back with this music, to my grandmother, who was the solid person in my family when I was growing up. She was a deeply religious woman. And she wore her emotion and her seriousness on her sleeve. And so there was no messing around. I mean, she's the reason I still wear a coat and tie to church. I mean, I just kept just my grandmother's for everybody else to walk around in their sweaters and drinking coffee. Not me. I mean, so that's who she was as a woman. And I see my grandmother and her angst and her joys, but I see her life in this music, and it makes me appreciate it differently.
That's fantastic. You said that you were determined to have this Ellington piece on, and right. And there, you know, nobody's going to argue with the fact that Ellington is one of America's great composers, but what is it about Harlem Suite, this parallel tone of Harlem, that that made you so determined to include this piece on the program?
It's the most fun. I'm not going to lie to you. It's just the most fun. You know, I said to a reporter the other day that what people complain about Duke Ellington's symphonic music is that it seems to be, you know, the term pastiche from the early, you know, 19th century. He said it's kind of like that. It's like through composed. It's almost like he said, here's a little bit of this, and here's a little bit of this, and here's a rumba, and here's a big band sound, and here's a New Orleans jazz slow march, and it's all in there. And there is no through line that connects all the dots. You just have to be willing to go, oh, so this is where we are now. Oh, this is kind of nice too, you know. And then, you know, the piece comes to an end, and you're just, and who gives the percussion section a cadenza, for crying out loud? I mean, you know, that's like giving a kid a pair of scissors and says, run, you know. So it's just a fun piece. And when I was asked about putting this kind of program together, I knew two pieces had to be on the program. I knew the Roberto Sierra had to be on the program, and I knew that this particular Duke Ellington had to be on the program.
Fantastic. That's great. Thomas Wilkins, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for doing this program, and we're really looking forward to it. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.